James trying to mark Gabriel, who comes surging in. He's not needed. Timber was there for Arsenal, and they're back in front. Sanchez complaining about a push. It's another good corner kick in. Was there an arm on the goalkeeper? If there was, it wasn't much from Saliba, if at all. Goalkeeper wasn't strong enough. The goal stands.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graeme Sibley, and as ever, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Yes, they're both back this week, so all of us together to talk about, well, football. That's the name on the podcast, isn't it? Still, we've not changed it yet, have we? No, we're still the Sound of Football. After an eventful weekend, so plenty to talk about, you'd say. Plenty of football to talk about, but Terry, we've been talking a lot about football recently, haven't we? So maybe we can talk about the laws of the game instead.
Mm.
Yeah?
Mm. The laws of football?
Yes. Yeah, because they're so important, there wouldn't be a game without them, would there?
It's very true. It wouldn't be a game without laws, and it's very, very important that we have them. And it would appear it's also very, very important that people keep altering the laws.
Yes, it is. But we will talk a little bit about football before we get on to that very, very, very important chat. You know, we offer you something really, really, really tasty to tempt you and keep you listening, listeners. But we should really talk about football first. But, of course, what we have to do is welcome Jan back on, because Jan wasn't here last week. So he missed out on the Tottenham relegation chat, which was hilarious. You really missed out there. You would have had a lot of input into that one. But you weren't very well, but you're better now, aren't you?
I am better now, yes. I'm no longer delirious.
Yes. Now, listeners, we do have to address this because poor old Jan went down a hole. He really, really wasn't very well. And in his fever dream, he was suddenly presented with the fear that Sunderland might go down. Now, this is something that he's been consistent with him all season. But it's very difficult when you're not very well. Maybe your head's not in the right place. So what sort of wacky new age treatment did you give yourself then, Jan?
I asked AI if it would calm my nerves and help me feel a little bit better about the remainder of the season for Sunderland. So I use AI a lot in my work, as I think a lot of people do now, because it solves lots of problems for me and it does coding, because I can't do any coding, but it can. Anyway, so lying there in my fever dream, I was suddenly overcome by the fact that I thought Sunderland were definitely going to get relegated. So I fired up Gemini and said, like, how many points do you need to stay up this season? And it went through a few things and then said, would you like me to go through some of the clubs just to see, you know, where I think they're going to finish? I went, no, just Sunderland. Then it went through this very logical, clearly well thought out summary of the rest of the season to put me at ease. And I still didn't. I was like, yeah, but what about this? What about that? And it ended up being this like therapy session for my virus-addled brain. And it just kept saying, look, Jan, they need 3 points. They need 3 points, then they're staying up. They're finishing between 10 and 12. As long as they get those 3 points, they're fine. But yeah, but what about this one? What about the Newcastle match? What about, but you know, we've got to go to Bournemouth at the week. And this was off the back of 3 wins. Anyway, I... eventually, I kind of gave in and went, well, it clearly does know better than me, because Sunderland went and got one of the 3 required points at the weekend and everything was fine. But yeah, it was a bit of a rabbit hole I went down. But actually, it did give me some quite interesting analysis. So it did prove its worth.
There you go, listeners. You see, AI isn't all evil. It can bring you back from delirium. Terry, we should be heartened by this news, shouldn't we?
What, that AI can bring everything back, or that Sunderland are actually not going down, which we have been saying. I don't know how long we've been saying this for. I mean, I have been saying it actually since May, but I mean, I've been believing it since September. you talk about how AI is taking over and replacing people's jobs and stuff like that, but it's also replacing the functions of friends as well. I mean, like, you know, Jan doesn't trust his friends to assure him that everything is fine with Sunderland and they are not going down. He has to get some stupid pound shop chat GPT to tell him, and now he's convinced. Thanks, mate. Cheers. Next time he fancy going out for a pint, ask Gemini.
In Jan's defence, he was delirious at the time.
Fine, all right, I'll allow it. But all I'm going to say to you, Jan, one thing, Gemini never stands its rounds. Never.
Be like having my brother-in-law there, wouldn't it?
Oh, that's staying in.
So it should.
It's funny because it's not true, listeners. It's not true.
And yet we're laughing. It's strange how comedy works, isn't it, Terry?
It's one of those things that resonates for some reason without actually being true.
Well, secret of comedy, listeners, secret of comedy. So let's talk about some football then, because there was football. Well, they said there was football this weekend, but really, was there, or was there just a load of wrestling at corners? Terry, what did you make of the grappling this weekend?
Just because I don't get on board with the snootiness of some football hipsters going, "Oh, football's becoming enchitified," because one, that's the incorrect use of the term enchitification, and two, I just can't get on board with that kind of thing. However, it is probably reasonable to say that the Premier League these days is a series of set pieces followed by the occasional goal, and then the referee blows up for full time. You've got either scrimmages or you've got dead balls. And occasionally what the players do is pass the ball to each other in order to set up a set piece. So it's much, much closer in character to a gridiron football these days, or perhaps rugby, than it has been. I'm being a little bit impish when I say this. But yeah, I think it is fair to say that set pieces are playing a much, much bigger role in football, as indeed it would appear is jostling. Now, to what extent this is a permanent thing, I'm not convinced. I don't think it's anything to panic about, but then at the same time, I don't imagine that anyone's going to stop panicking. Because, you know, people like to panic.
Oh, they do. They do like to panic. They do like to be outraged by things as well. And they do like to just stick their oar in, don't they? Because, you know, there's a lot of space for people to have comment. This is half an hour of it, where we're having our go at it. But, yeah, what do you think? Do you think that football is being ruined by set pieces and corners and jostling and long throws and all that sort of stuff?
No, not at all. I think it just adds to it, really, doesn't it? I think this season's been quite refreshing that we've had a little bit more of that. Long balls seem to have come back into vogue. The long throw, which I've always been a fan of because I'm a Sunderland fan, and we've had historically players that can chuck the ball in, which has helped in some cases. But yeah, I haven't really got a problem with it. I don't understand what the issue is with having a long throw, what the issue is with pushing home your advantage on a corner kick. I think that's fine. I suppose the only thing I struggle with is the grappling, because it's clear there is just a load of blokes fouling each other. But I don't know how you would control that given the number of players that are there. And as well as that, having watched football for many, many, many years, there's always been pushing and shoving and a bit of holding at corners anyway. So maybe it's gone up a little bit. I don't know. But people are talking about it more. Maybe it's just because there are more goals getting scored from corners, and that's shining a light on the fact that there's a little bit of thuggery that goes on inside of the 6-yard box. But no, I'm not really losing sleep over it. And if I do, I just speak to Gemini and he soothes my fevered brow.
I can't believe, Graham, that we have more jostling in the area than we've ever had before. I may wonder, a lot of this might be because of the depth of TV coverage and it's just much, much easier to pick these things up. I don't know. I mean, it probably goes in waves, but this just feels like a kind of panic. It doesn't feel like it's grounded in anything. I mean, I'm not saying jostling doesn't happen and wrestling doesn't happen. And I'm not saying it can't be excessive, but I'm just saying I don't see this as being a new problem.
Well, no. And it's something that Howard Webb, the head of the PGA MOL, was going to tackle this season. At the beginning of this season, he said that you can expect to see a lot more penalties for holding at set pieces. And it doesn't seem to have happened. It may have happened in the first month or so, but I don't recollect that many penalties being awarded. So is it something you can actually do about it? Or do we just have the game that we deserve because this is what we want to see? We want to see people being physical at set pieces like corners. We don't want to see everyone just like holding off, hands behind their back, seeing, well, let's see if we can move into the right zone and win it fairly. Am I oversimplifying things here, Terry?
I wonder whether or not this could be equated with the rise of the set-piece coach.
Yeah.
And the jostling these days is more tactical than before. Whereas perhaps it was more like in the old days, and when I say the old days, I mean 5 years ago, it was more like a bundle, you know, more of a kind of schoolyard bundle. Jostling for position, you know, chugging his hang around a bit, you know, being a bit physical, having a few verbals, maybe a quick sneaky one, you know, down the back of the heel and stuff like that. But nothing necessarily tactical, stuff that sort of like, you know, the dark arts that, you know, we're always hearing about. But now you wonder whether or not set piece coaches are sort of like saying it's more than just, well, you know, you guys form a line, he'll clip it in or with the outside of his boot, and then you run in and then you come back out and then you go back in again and then you beat the offside trap. And then there's at least five attackers there in an onside position ready to score. That seems more like the kind of magic and the artistry of set-piece coaching. But actually, they're also then teaching them, well, you know, what we want to do is we want to create chaos in the middle of there. So you have him, you have him, you have him. And then rather than marking him, you wrestle him. And it just maybe feels like it could be a bit more planned. And maybe that's the issue. And maybe that's what people are seeing. And maybe that's what people are saying, well, look, hang on, this is a different sport. This is not how it should be. It's one thing to compete for space. It's another thing to perhaps deliberately, you know, to play, I don't know, like some kind of basic version of gridiron football where you've got players squaring up. And to be fair, that is a different sport. So perhaps there is a grounds for some concern in that respect from critics. But I guess we would probably only really know that in the fullness of time. As to whether or not it's a tactical trend or whether or not it's something that's here to stay.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Do you think that maybe this is something to do with the minutiae, the level of analysis in football? As Terry said, we now have set-piece coaches, people who are paid good money to help your team maximise set-pieces. We have teams that are successfully staying in the middle table because they are squeezing every marginal gain they possibly can from the money they invest. And the ones like Brentford, who have all of the data, they have all of the data when it comes to set pieces and plays and everything. And they have all the data analysis there as well to back it up. Is this just every club trying to keep up with that level of analysis? Is that what we've really got here? And this is just the natural end of where all that analysis goes to?
Yeah, I think that's probably likely. There is a science to this, well, to all sports, and to the, you know, the human body and all that type of stuff that goes into the running of the club. And yeah, so you're going to look at all of the tiny bits of data, those minuscule movements and things like that that happen in all aspects of the game, and you're going to see what you can squeeze out of it. And I don't see what's wrong with that. It doesn't necessarily impact how enjoyable the game is. Some games are great, some games are terrible. And that has been the case since I started watching football like 40 years ago. So I don't think much has changed on that point. But yeah, I mean, you've got to take advantage of what's out there. And if you're not going to do that, you're going to sink. And I think it's fine at the professional level. You'd kind of expect that, really. I mean, I would imagine it's not going to be as pronounced as you go further down, even inside of the professional level. But that comes down to just finance, I suppose. You probably can't afford to have somebody coaching you on free kicks and corners and throw-ins and things like that. If you're at the bottom of tier three, you're going to have more of it at a higher level. But then again, a lot of people watch that level, so it's going to become more exposed. I really don't have a problem with it. I don't think it's a massive deal either. You know, you've got to find those marginal gains, Graham, as you said. So why not do it?
Yeah, you're quite right to point out that, you know, you've got clubs like Brentford and also Brighton who've got, you know, big data and proprietary data sets to work with. But I mean, I've just had a quick look on the old internet here. And surprisingly, it's the top clubs that are getting the most out of this move as well. I mean, you know, Arsenal lead the league, but they also lead the table on set-piece goals for non-penalties. 18 scored from 28. then after that is City, and then after that is Villa, then Man United and Chelsea. I mean, none of these clubs are the middle-class clubs. Doesn't mean the middle-class clubs aren't making gains in that area. It just means, obviously, because they're just playing in a slightly different league within a league in that area. They just don't score as many goals. But it's something that clearly the well-financed teams see as a competitive advantage. It's probably something that will even itself out at some point. And that includes, yes, excessive physicality or tactical physicality within the penalty area. The likelihood is that a coach or coaches will come along and say, well, look, we figured out a way of combating this. And they'll do that. And that is how I think these problems in sports should be overcome. It should be overcome by the athletes and their coaches figuring out ways of getting around it, of nullifying the tactical advantage. That's sport. That's sporting excellence. In fact, that's humanity. That's how we overcome our problems. We don't really overcome them by having a bunch of old guys come along and saying, you can stop doing that now, because it seldom works. And it just isn't necessary. It's not ruining everything. I mean, if people... I know there's this kind of... is it dichotomy, the word I'm looking for? Between there are people who look at football and say, it must be beautiful. It must be entertaining. It must be fun to watch. And then there's another set of people who say, well, that's not how I see football. I see football. I want my team to win. I see the merit and benefit in using tactical advantages, maybe playing a bit ugly in order to achieve a result, particularly against a superior opposition, and see as much romance and fun and beauty in that as the sort of, like, if you like, the people who think that the game should be art rather than artisanship. And I mean, I sit in the second camp personally, but I don't think there's any problem with the balance. It's sort of like if the tension goes one way or the other. And it would appear at the moment that it is all a little bit set piece. It's a little bit long ball. Perhaps it's a little bit early 90s. We've talked about this earlier in the season. But again, I think it's the same conclusion that we have here. You know, it's not something I think that will last. And yeah, the athletes, the footballers and the coaches will find a way sooner or later.
For me, is a reliance on set pieces any worse than a low block? Because that's ubiquitous now. When you get two banks of four or more just closing out whenever the opposition is in possession, denying space, denying opportunities, which is a craft in itself.
If players had played a mid or high block against City in the FA Cup final, they'd have lost the game 4-0.
Yeah.
So there's your answer. I mean, yeah. You're right. You can say that. You could extend it anywhere. I mean, like, clubs do not owe fans entertainment.
No,
in my opinion,
especially not neutral fans. Yeah.
No, certainly. Oh God, neutral fans do not come into this at all.
Yeah.
Enjoy your football, have fun, but how dare you tell me how to support my team, and how dare you tell my team how to win cup finals against vastly superior opposition? Sod off.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do whatever it takes. And I wouldn't want to see that. This is not a beauty contest. It's not ice skating. It's football.
Yeah, you don't get extra points for winning pretty, do you?
No.
You might pick up extra fans. And I suppose if you are a broadcaster, you might think, well, is my product becoming less attractive because of this? And this was the problem we had in the 80s. People honestly thought that football was going down a dark route, and then the Premier League came along and everything was fine again, because money just suddenly started pouring into the game. This goes back to what we were saying earlier about the fact that it's not just the middle clubs doing this, it's the top clubs. And this is what happened in the 80s. It was started off with Wimbledon being the long ball team, and soon everyone was doing it. Everyone was doing it, and everyone was playing much more direct. Even Man United. Man United had this great feeling that under Ferguson they were just sweeping attacking moves. It was basically balls down the channels to very, very fast wingers and two holding players at the back. You got Roy Keane and Paul Ince there just winning back position just so they could just chuck it up as quickly as possible. George Graham at Arsenal, winning titles with a very, very direct physical approach. The sort of approach that Wimbledon were being lambasted for in the early 80s. And now the top teams, the title-winning teams, are doing it. And so this is what you're getting nowadays with these set pieces, I'm sure of it. You say, Jan, about how far down this goes. We know at non-league, kids' football now, they've all got VOs. Everyone is recording these matches. Even training matches, five-a-side matches are being recorded on VOs. You don't even have to buy the VO camera now. Now you can just have a little holder that holds your iPhone in there, giving you all of the facilities that a VO camera has. And even the price point of a VO camera, I think, is about £1,200 now. So if you're really into it, if you want to make a career out of being a football coach, and we've seen for ourselves that a coach at Whiteley 5 years ago was caretaker manager of Chelsea just a couple of months ago. So the pathways are there. So it doesn't surprise me at all that everyone is taking advantage, because you've got coaches who are in a very competitive market. Look at Brentford. Brentford are actually managed by their set-piece coach now. That's his pathway. That's the way he's got to success. What we come to now, though, is what people who don't like all this, what they want to see done. And it looks like they want the rules changed. It looks like they want things sped up so you can't take that much more advantage from set pieces. So this week, IFAB have been putting together a few ideas about how things can change, including things like a 5-second counter on throw-ins. Jan, I bet you can't wait for a 5-second counter on throw-ins, can you?
I mean, it's been a long time coming, Grim. I mean, for these throw-ins that have taken 6 and 7 seconds, I mean, it's destroying the game. It really is.
Really is.
I mean,
really
there
is.
Was one the other day where it was about 8 seconds. I just turned the telly off.
Yeah.
I sat the telly off and I read a book. I mean, who wants to do that on a Sunday? I mean, this obviously, I'm joking. It's ridiculous. It's silly, really, isn't it? Considering what we've... And a beautiful segue, by the way, Graham. But, of course, we're trying to find tactical advantages. The clubs have done that. So we've got a guy who can chuck a ball into the box from a distance that ordinarily wouldn't have happened a few seasons ago. Well, I'm saying that. It's been going on for a while, hasn't it? There's always been someone who can throw a long ball. But the fact he might take 6 or 7 seconds to throw it in, is that really ruining football? I just don't think it is. I think what I think you hit the nail on the head earlier, Graham, when you said that it's the product that I think people are concerned as being somehow tarnished because of corner kicks, grappling, long throws, people getting towels out to dry the ball and things like that. And we don't want it like that. We want this imaginary football that doesn't exist and has never existed, but only ever exists in little tiny pockets, and that's what makes it beautiful. But if you try and manufacture that so it happens all of the time, well, it's never going to happen, and it just feels a bit like fiddle brick, and that's what's going to happen. Because you know, there's a few things that we kind of grumble about offsides and things like that. Maybe we'll come to that later. And handballs, they've become more complicated because we've been putting more rules into them. When, you know, maybe we should just let it play its course. It's supposed to be a simple game. You've got 11 aside, you've got one ball, and it should just play its course. Creating rules, I know it's not for the sake of creating more laws, sorry, I should say, but I just don't think that it's that big a deal that we need to address it. It's not a big deal if your side scores from a long throw. I quite like it. Obviously, when it's the shoes on the other foot, I'm raging. But, you know, that's the way it is. But you're right. It's not about the neutrals, as you said. And if that's what it's trying to address to make it prettier and bring more people into the market and the product, then, you know, I think that's misguided.
Interesting point about long throws. Do you guys know why you can't be offside from a throw-in?
No.
I mean, I don't. I'm just sitting here guessing, but then I've just remembered we're doing a podcast. I just sit here in silence for 5 minutes while I don't figure that out. So, yeah, no, please tell me.
The rule was changed, I think, in 1921. Now, back then, the offside trap had become so good that it was very, very difficult to score. The amount of goals was at an all-time low. And one of the problems was throw-ins, because you needed two defenders ahead of you rather than just one, is what it is now. So all you'd need to do was get a line of players up to where the throw-in was, have one person sweeping, and if anyone was ahead of that, then they'd be offside. And so, like, the one sweeping guy could clear it up. So they thought, okay, well, just say you can't be offside from a throw-in. But 2 years after that, the situation would have been cleared out anyway, because they changed offside to one defender instead of two. But they never changed the throw-in law back again. So they kept it there, even though it wasn't necessary anymore. And it's been there for 100 years now. So Yeah, I thought that's an interesting aside, and I wonder if they've ever thought about putting offside back in for that. But considering what they're doing with the offside rule, I wouldn't think so. Terry, what do you think about something as innocuous as time at throw-ins? Are you getting fed up of seeing towels? Is that what it is?
I get massive towel rage. I get massive towel rage when I just think, getting the towels out. And it makes me very, very angry. I mean, I think that if there's going to be towels, then it has to be towels for both teams as well. Got to have consistency. That's all I ask for. If I see another throw-in being taking longer than there's, 8 or 9 seconds, I'm just going to cancel my Sky subscription and tell them why. Tell them why. Even if I'm watching the game on TNT, I'm cancelling my Sky subscription. I'm blaming Sky for this. Okay, so I guess if you really go back to basics here, the purpose of the throw-in is that the ball has gone into touch and it needs to be put back onto the pitch. That is basically what a throw-in is. And the idea, I think, is that you just get the ball and you just like chuck it back on. So if you think of it like that, then yeah, it is overstretching the tactical advantage of the throw-in and like not using the throw-in for what it's originally intended, which is just simply to resume play. And there's a degree of tactical advantage depending on who put the ball back into touch. But I think that that's naive. And I was going to say at the elite level, but at any level, you know, when you're playing a game of football, even if you're playing on the park, you know, those guys aren't kicking the ball around and having fun. They want to win. Of course they want to win. I mean, like, you know, they might have 3 kids and only 1 knee, you know, between, you know, 11 players. But they're competitive. They'll want to take a competitive advantage. So let's be realistic about it. Well, actually, you know what? I've got a great idea. Why don't we leave it for the referees to decide if it's taking too long? What do you think? The referee judges the game. And thinks, what time is it? Where are we? Oh, 5 minutes in. All right, yeah, okay, this is fine. All right, okay, well, we're 5 minutes into injury time and someone's faffing around on the touchline trying to... Yeah, no, you know what? I don't think that's in the spirit of the game. That's not gentleman. That's not sportsmanlike conduct. I'm going to call you up on that, maybe give you a yellow card for time wasting. Maybe that's a good idea. And then that way,
Terry,
you don't have to worry about it.
No. You cannot have that because...
Why not?
Because... These are the human referees you're talking about, right?
Well, yeah, of course, yeah.
No, because you're going to go, referee A is going to be slightly okay with that, and then referee B is going to be a little less okay with that. And then consistency goes out the window. You've got anarchy, Terry. Is that what you want? Is that what you want, Terry?
I completely forgot about the lack of consistency, and I definitely forgot about the anarchy, Graham.
Yeah,
no, I stand corrected.
Anarchy. Towels.
You can't have anarchy
everywhere. Towels everywhere, Terry. That's what it'll be. That's where it'll end up.
It will. Towels.
Yeah.
VAR. More yeah. Towels.
Yeah.
We'll have a towel law.
There'll be a... Oh, stop it.
And while we take this towel break, here are some messages from our sponsors.
Will they be towel manufacturers?
I was going to say, they'll probably buy Jan's towels.
Salary tailors.
Yes. Yes.
Terry's towels. Yes. Your towels from this towel off was sponsored by Terry's towels.
Yeah. Futures for Egyptian cotton suddenly skyrocket. yeah. But, of course, they are mucking about with... offside. Of course they are. It's not been 5 minutes since the last time they mucked about with offside. Wenger's law is another thing that is making the headlines this week because it's been introduced into a league to test it out. And if you're not familiar with Wenger's law, listeners, this is it. Arsene Wenger has the idea that if any part of you is level with the last defender, then you're onside. Okay, so there would have to be daylight between you and the last defender for you to be offside. That's the basis of it. And they're testing this in the Canadian Premier League, a league that has no VAR. And so, well, if it works here, let's introduce it into leagues which does have VAR. Now, for me, I think I can see why they're going for this. They're going for this because they hate the idea of the fact that level is now no longer a thing. You cannot no longer be level. The introduction of VAR has been a step backwards. In many cases, literally a step backward as far as the offside rule is concerned. The offside law was changed, I think, in 1990 after the World Cup. The World Cup had very, very few goals in it. And so it was changed so that you could be level. You could be sat on the shoulder of the last defender, and it would be just basically a foot race. The ball over the top would be a foot race. Now, of course, a forward does not know if he's level. He does not know if he's level. He can think he's level. He can be standing shoulder to shoulder with the last defender. But once those lines come on, or once the veil of death for a semi-automated VAR comes down, then he may not be. His knee may be out there, or impossible for a player to tell. So he has to take at least half a step back to make sure, or just gamble on it anyway. Now the gamble is, well, if you're that far forward, then yeah. Okay, so it's giving them an extra half a step the other way, rather than half step back, half step forward. So that's a good thing, though, isn't it, Jan?
So just to clarify, if any part of your body is onside,
yeah,
then under Wenger's law,
yeah,
you're onside. So
yeah,
if not me, obviously, because I couldn't do this, but if you're a forward and you've taken a big step away from the defender who is marking you as the ball's played, but your heel is in line with his big toe.
Yep.
You're onside.
You are good to go, my friend, yes.
So how is that any different to what happens now when your toe is slightly offside?
Well, I guess
it's going to have the same problem, in reverse.
It is, but at least I suppose then you're taking that gamble. You're taking that gamble by being that much ahead. So it's meant to keep you not from going to the extreme, but you know, if you're going to the extreme, then you know, that's up to you.
If I'm understanding it right, I would suggest to you that way what you're doing is that you are hoping to reduce the number of offsides while at the same time not getting rid of VAR. So you still need VAR to judge that the very back of the heel is in line with the very front toe of the centre half. But what you are doing is you're giving the advantage to the attacking player because they've got that extra bit of space, as Graves says, that extra step or two steps to work with against the last defender or the second to last defender. And that a good striker would then be able to use that a little better than where we are right now, because as Graham successfully points out, it is impossible to be level. So if it's impossible to be level, then the law is pointless, right? Because it's impossible. So what they're asking them to do is it's impossible to be level, so therefore, how can we have a law that says level? I mean, that needs to change. That's just because that's what VAR has given us. That's the gift that VAR has given us. So then obviously it does need to be a change. But that's what I suspect is the thinking behind the law, is to give the tactical advantage to the striker, and for the striker, therefore, to better beat the offside trap more often, and then we have more goals. And then we still get to keep VAR for the marginal decisions, and then that way Sony are still happy and they don't go around breaking fingers. Not that they would do that. Sorry. I said that part out loud. I should have said that in the back of my head.
Yeah. Back of your head.
I can't get away from the fact that level now doesn't exist because of VAR. So now we're going to change the laws because of VAR.
Again.
And as we've talked about, and the last time we talked about VAR, which was a couple of weeks ago, I think, just to look at this little island, just to take one country.
Yeah. Every weekend there are just 15 games. Out of the many thousands of games that are played, only 15 are played with VAR. So, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
Well, I think...
And you're changing the rules just for those 15 games.
Well, I think that, you know, the criticism is laid bare there, isn't it?
Yeah.
We don't need to make this change for 15 games. I mean, how many divisions, how many divisions across Europe have got VAR in it?
Well,
most of the top divisions of the big, well, certainly the big five have all got it.
Two in Germany, one in Scotland, one in Italy, one in France.
Yeah, one in Spain.
One in Spain.
Yeah, but they're all slightly different, all of them. When VAR was introduced, it was by FIFA, there were certain stipulations that you had to have, number of camera points and positions. And I think that's been largely ignored now, just so that they can squeeze it into as many. I think that's even ignored in some respects. I don't have any proof of this, but I think that those original specs are actually ignored in the Premier League, because I don't think teams coming up are going to change their grounds enough to have the full VAR as it was originally specced out. And I think this is why you have problems at grounds like Molineux and at the Vitality, why decisions there can sometimes take a bit longer, because I don't think they've got all the cameras in the right places there.
I wonder if that was the case at Turf Moor as well on Saturday.
It could well be. Could well be.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But hey, football will continue, the imperfect thing that it is. So if you really can bear to watch it, because there's going to be a hell of a lot of towels. Oh, I just realised. Because it's FA Cup weekend this weekend, and I suddenly thought, oh, great, no VAR. But of course, it's fifth round, and VAR comes in now, doesn't it? But hey, it's FA Cup weekend. So FA Cup is always nice. It's always a little bit of a break away from the Premier League, and even if VAR does stink it out. Starts off on Friday with Wolves-Liverpool. I've put Wrexham-Chelsea in there because it's been given one of the prime slots for it. Newcastle versus Man City again. And Sunderland are in there, Jan, but you don't know who you're playing yet, do you?
No, we don't. So we're playing the winner of Port Vale or Bristol City.
Yeah.
If we go to, say, Port Vale,
yeah,
they don't have VAR. Neither do Mansfield. How do you make that happen?
No, you only have VAR where it's at.
Oh, I
see. So they won't have it at Wrexham. It'll be at Leeds Norwich, and it'll be at Newcastle City, but it won't be at Mansfield Arsenal.
Well, that's good to know.
Can I make a prediction? I know we don't do predictions in the Sound Football Guys, but can I say that what's going to happen is that Chelsea are going to score a goal. It's going to be super, 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 super contentious. And Chelsea are going to win the game by a goal, and Wrexham are going to lose their nuts because they don't have VAR. They're going to lose their nuts. And like Rob Mack and Deadpool Guy, they're going to be going onto the socials saying, we should have VAR in the championship. We should have VAR in a league that we're leaving in 1 to 2 years anyway. And then they'll get it because they're massively popular guys and everyone loves them. And say, okay. And that'll be that. That's why it's in the box set, guys.
Yeah.
It's because this is the moment that sets off the chain of events that brings VAR to the championship. And one of the reasons why, of course, Championship is a great league is it doesn't have VAR.
Yep, that's right. Not for long, though. Not for long.
The Wrexham story is a wonderful story, but they will ruin everything sooner or later. Sorry, Wrexham people. I know we have Wrexham listeners, and I'm really sorry. I'm so happy for you. I really am. But your team is going to ruin everything.
It's true. Yeah. Because we can't have anything nice, okay? That's why ever in football. You should know that by now, listeners. But we can have something nice on Saturday as well, because our World Cup qualifying for the Lionesses, that starts on Saturday as well. So celebrate International Women's Day with some international football. If you want to see what games get into our box set, including Wrexham versus Chelsea, then get along to sofpodcast.com, click on the link for the weekend box set, and subscribe to our Substack, and it'll be in your inbox on Friday. But that is all we have time for this week. So from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFerlin, it's goodbye.
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 Get in touch with us on Blue Sky or Instagram, where we are at Sound of Football, or go to sofpodcast.com. Like us, share us, rate us and review us. Do it now! Put your towel away.
How did you know I've got my towel?
You've always got your towel.
I'm only wearing a towel.
Big fan of towels being the symbol of everything that's wrong with modern football. I do like it. I mean, I look forward to not hearing Simon Jordan's latest diatribe on how towels are ruining everything.
Bloody towels.
Because it's coming.
Towels coming over here.
Towels. Gary, if you're listening, say something about towels on your next broadcast. Yes. Then we'll know you're hearing us.
Yes. The smell of
give
towels.
Give us a sign, Gary. Anything.
The smell
anything.
Of towels.
The smell of towels.
Oh,
I know we've stopped recording, Gary, but please.
He's not pressed stop yet, have you, Grim?
Of course
he hasn't.